And welcome to the latest edition of City Parents Talk. I'm Anna Richards from City Parents, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Grace Marshall. Grace is a coach who specialises in efficiency and productivity. She's head coach and chief encourager at gracemarshall.com, Productivity Ninja, and Think Productive. She's also the author of Struggle, The Surprising Truth, Beauty and Opportunity Hidden in Life's Shittier Moments. My apologies for swearing and for any other swearing during the course of this interview. It'll only be in reference to Grace's book and no offence of any kind is intended. Grace, thank you so much for joining me today. Please, let's start by telling us broadly and briefly about your book and what it's all about.
Thanks so much for having me, Anna. It's great to be here. So the book is called Struggle. It's about the times that we often don't like to talk about. So it's about times when things go wrong, times when we get it wrong, maybe even times of conflict when I think you're wrong or you think I'm wrong. And I noticed that we all experience struggle, and yet it's the one thing we very rarely talk about. And if we do talk about it, we talk about it with a sense of either shame or blame. You know, it's like, oh gosh, that's an unfortunate thing to happen. Or we see it as a sign that we're not enough, that somehow we're not coping. So we tend to talk about it in a very limited way. And what I wanted to do was explore it and think, actually, what if we've got it wrong about getting it wrong? What if actually struggle is not just a sign of things going wrong, an obstacle or a battle to fight or even a trap to avoid? What if it's the birthplace of some of our best work? And actually, if we learn to look at it differently, we can maybe shine a light in the middle of the tunnel rather than a light at the end of the tunnel. So what if we can learn to look at struggle differently, and therefore we can start to experience it differently and show up differently for ourselves and for each other as well?
I really like that analogy of the tunnel, because I've been thinking in the lead up to this podcast and how in life's more difficult times, often positives do emerge, but do we realise them at the time, or is it much further down the line? And how can we realise, oh, okay, we're in the depths of it now, and how can we turn this tough time into something positive? Do you think it's all about that perspective?
It comes into it a lot, because what we tend to do is we respond to struggle with a sense of fight or flight instinct. It's like something has gone wrong, therefore I'm not safe anymore and I need to protect myself. And the way that I do that is by going into defensive mode, and either I need to fight my way through or I just need to get out and escape or withdraw. And we see that a lot. So if you think about when the pandemic hit, a lot of us went, what can I control? And we ended up buying toilet paper, when actually that has no impact whatsoever on the pandemic. But it was a sense of people feeling like they could get a sense of control. So actually, when we view struggle with a sense of fight or flight, which is a very natural thing to do, our choices are limited to basically, how can I fight this or how can I run away? Whereas actually, with a lot of the struggle that we encounter at work and in life, what we actually need is a broader perspective. And we need to be able to think creatively. We need to be able to think compassionately. And all those things require a much more broader view, whereas fight and flight actually give us a very narrow view. So biologically, we get tunnel vision when we hit fight and flight, whereas actually a lot of the times when we're struggling at work or outside of work, what we need is that wider view to be able to see things from other people's perspectives, but also to be able to see like what opportunity is there here in the middle of this challenging situation. And you're right, like often we look at things with hindsight and we get, oh yeah, of course. That moment of adversity is where I grew the most or where I learned the most. Or we talk about famous failures, like Thomas Edison's 10,000 ways not to make a light bulb. And like the post-it notes that started off as somebody looking for an ultra strong adhesive for the aircraft industry and ended up finding this kind of weak adhesive that you could like stick on and unstick and restick. And the post-it note was born. So all of these kind of happy accidents we find actually come from a time where things go wrong, when we deviate from the normal path. So we know that struggle is an inevitable part of success. But if we only think about it in the moment as, oh, this is the thing that's got in the way and it's taken me off track, then our fight and flight response will basically just narrow in on very narrow options. Whereas if we're able to zoom back out and go, okay, this is shit, to use that word, this feels really tough right now, and there could also be some useful things here. We could just learn to look at things differently in the moment. So it doesn't make it go away, but it puts us in a different position to be able to engage in that struggle in a different way.
I love the examples of the the failures or the mistakes. And you talk a lot in your book about making mistakes normal, which I think is a really interesting one to explore, because we're taught from such a young age, aren't we, that we shouldn't make mistakes, we should do everything right. And City Parents, as you know, is made up of a lot of working parents. And I suppose we tend to punish mistakes. That's how we're governed. How can we change that mindset, do you think? And have you got any thoughts about how we can teach that to children as well?
Gosh, yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. It's so much of it is conditioned. I think there's a lot of nurture, but a little bit of nature as well. And I think it's helpful to understand that nature. So to go back to that fight and flight instinct, it was evolved very much for physical threats, but it responds the same way to social threats. Because in the days when we all lived in caves, being rejected from the tribe would have been a life-threatening situation. So anything that we do where we fear that there might be a sense of rejection, there might be a sense of damage to your reputation, people might think less of you. All of those kind of social threats, in a way, our biological response to it is exactly the same. Our limbic brain responds to a social threat the same way that it responds to a physical threat. So if you think of that in the context of making mistakes, especially at work, it's like mistakes mean that somebody might think worse of me. It might mean that I lose opportunities. It might mean I lose my reputation. It might mean that I get fired. All of those things have a very tangible threat level to it. So that's the nature aspect of it. But then the nurture aspect of that is that we reinforce that. And we reinforce it by maybe sometimes in how we respond to other people's mistakes, or sometimes how we respond to our own mistakes as well. And I think a lot of it, I think we can account to the busy ways that we work. So the culture of speed that we have at work, where everything is about how quickly can you get it done? If you think about how often that comes into conversation, how quickly can you get that done? How soon can you deliver? Thanks for getting back to me so quickly. What we end up telling each other is what matters is speed. Like your performance is being measured by speed. And so if there's something that I'm trying to learn, I might make a mistake. That mistake is going to cost me. And it's going to mean that it's going to take me longer to fix. It's going to take me longer to actually deliver. Whereas if the alternative is, I could ask that person over there who's more experienced than me, who's probably gone through the learning process already, and they would have the answer. So I might end up asking them a question rather than learning it for myself, which means that next time around, I'll still have to ask the question. And if you then think about how often do you get like in a team, and I find this a lot when I work with people in the productivity work that I do, you'll get a couple of people in a team who are absolutely overloaded. And they're constantly interrupted with questions. And they want to help. They don't want to be the bottleneck in their own team. But the amount of questions they're being asked means that they don't get a chance to do their own stuff. And they're feeling behind on that. And often, if you look at the questions, they're often the same questions. Or they're the sort of questions that if you gave that person time to just think it through for themselves, they'd probably work out the answer. But it's quicker to ask the question. So that's what we do. And so you've got a whole load of junior people who never learn. And then you've got a whole load of more experienced people who are overworked and overloaded. And I'm sure you've had similar experiences and heard similar experience in the workplace as well. And then to make that worse, in terms of how we respond to other people's mistakes, if we're in a position where we're up against a deadline, we're super busy, we're overwhelmed, we're overworked, and then somebody else makes a mistake, as much as we might go in normal times, do you know what? It's human. We all make mistakes. Let's fix it and get over it. If in the moment you are up against the wall, you're far more likely to react in a way that's like, I can't believe you've done this to me. I know I've been in that place where I've realized actually I've packed things in so tightly that actually I leave no room. I'm demanding perfection from everybody else because there is no room in my schedule for mistakes. And so that becomes a vicious cycle. That we become more reticent to make a mistake and more like, oh, bad things really do happen if I make a mistake because somebody's going to shout at me, somebody's going to be upset with me. And therefore I might go, well, there's no room for me to make mistakes here. So I'm not going to take risks because I might make a mistake, or I might end up taking on the cost of it myself and end up overworking and always demanding perfection of myself because I don't want to be in that place where I make mistakes and then costing somebody else or costing me something. Does that resonate?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm cringing at the email I sent this morning that said, thank you for responding so speedily. But we do, you're absolutely right. And it makes so much sense. And I'm wondering, How can we stop that cycle? How can we as individuals stop that cycle? And how can managers and leaders perhaps help to improve the culture really that surrounds this, do you think?
First of all, it's understanding why do we want to stop it? I mean, from a well-being perspective, there's a strong case there. From a mental health perspective, there's a strong case. But I think there's also a strong case from a productivity and innovation perspective as well. Because we often look at the cost of making mistakes, don't we? But if we start to look at the cost of avoiding mistakes, if we create this culture where nobody is allowed to make mistakes, that means we don't grow, we don't develop, and we don't learn. It also means that we don't innovate because we're not willing to take the risks of doing something new when actually it's far safer to just keep doing what we're doing. And so from a business perspective, there's a strong case for creating an environment where it's okay to make mistakes. So how do we do that? Once we know, okay, yeah, I'm bought into it, how do we make that happen? I think a lot of it is to do with our language. So like you say, you know, how often do we say, thanks for getting back to me so quickly? We inadvertently support that culture of speed. So how can we be a bit more deliberate about the language that we use and the conversations that we're starting? Maybe we can have conversations about, what are you learning? What are you wrestling with? What are you struggling with? And not like, what are you struggling with and I'm going to judge you for it, but actually genuinely with curiosity, what are we struggling with? And being able to kind of share that and talk openly about it and be able to respond to that with curiosity and not shame, but also be able to respond to it with a sense of, oh, okay, let's work with that. And I'm with you on it, rather than, oh, I need to fix that for you. Because if we get into fixing mode, then you attach that judgment and shame back to it as well. But I think also maybe in how we talk about mistakes as well. So if somebody has made a mistake, being able to support each other and kind of almost go, hey, you're human. Like, first of all, yes, you're human. It's okay to make a mistake. And in the moment, it might be a case of, okay, how do we fix this? And what do we need to do? But maybe taking a moment afterwards to go, what happened? Like with a genuine curiosity. So it's not what happened in terms of why did you make a mistake, but actually what caused that? Like, how did that happen? And it might be, oh, do you know what? It happened because I'm too busy. I pack things in too tightly. Or maybe it's happening because, gosh, the process has changed. Maybe there are too many variables in the process and it's so easy for mistakes to happen. And that can then give us some really useful information about how we maybe change and look at that process. So I think it's being willing to have conversations about the mistakes themselves, but also being willing to point to what can we learn from them rather than like, oh, how can we make sure you never do that again?
Some really nice reflections there. So thinking about children, Grace, and their approach to mistakes, how can we help children to see making mistakes as not only okay, but actually a positive as they learn and grow?
This relates really interestingly to parenting, because quite often, I don't know about you, Anna, but for me, I've gotten used to being the fixer for my kids. So when they were little, every time they cried, every time they needed me, my role was to fix things for them. If they're too hot, I need to fix that. If they're too cold, if they're tired, if they're hungry, my job is basically to fix things for them. And as they've grown older, I've noticed that there's actually a transition that happens where my role changes. And if I'm too used to being the fixer, which, you know, to be honest, I enjoy being able to fix things for them. But actually there comes a point where they need to know that they can fix things for themselves. And what I noticed was if they say to me, Mummy, I'm struggling, this is hard. And I say, oh, honey, it's not that hard. Let me show you how. It's really easy. You know, let me figure it out for you, or let me do it for you. I might do that out of all good intention of wanting to kind of make things better for them. But actually what they hear from me is, oh, this isn't supposed to be hard. And I'm not supposed to be struggling. And maybe there's something wrong with me. So what they need to hear from me more often nowadays as they're getting older is, do you know what, honey? Yeah, that does suck. That is hard. And that's okay. And to borrow a phrase from Glennon Doyle, the author, we can do hard things. And actually that's far more empowering. And I think that also applies to making mistakes, that actually when they make a mistake, that the conversation we have with them isn't, oh, why did you do that? But also, you know, to be able to say to them, I make mistakes too. And even having the same conversations that we might have with a colleague, we have that same conversation with our kids of going, oh, what happened there? And helping them to get curious so that they know that a mistake isn't the end of something. It's not a failure. Okay, that went a different direction to how I thought it was going to go. What can I learn from that? And what learning can I take forwards? So I think part of it is the empathy that we develop, and for them to know that it's a very human thing to make mistakes and it's a very human thing to struggle. So for them to see us talking and doing that, I think is really important. But also helping them to think through and how we model for them how they can respond to themselves in that struggle as well.
Very sound advice. Thank you. I'm going to take that one forward. One of the lovely scenes from your book was of a guard in a busy station concourse. He was fielding questions and complaints from passengers. I think we all can remember the rather familiar scenes of the delay boards across the train station. And this guard, he wasn't being defensive. He wasn't trying to fix it. He was just saying what he knew, fielding questions and guidance as best he could, and just showing up, which lends itself a lot to the language you've just talked to. I'm wondering what we can all learn from this guard, particularly in the case of corporate culture, perhaps leaders trying to help in more difficult situations.
So again, if I go back to fight and flight as the alternatives, fight is, why are you having a go at me? There's nothing I can do about this. You know, that I didn't cause this to happen. And we can end up getting confrontational when there's something that happens that's outside of our control and people are directing their frustration or their anger or their emotions at us. And you can see that happening a lot in the corporate world. So say if a decision's been made or something has happened that's beyond your control and yet you're getting the brunt of it because you're right on the ground where everybody is emotional and upset. And so you're getting the face of it. So fight can end up taking the fight back to them and you get confrontational. Flight is almost like we run away, we avoid the situation, we go, there's nothing I can do about this, so therefore I'm just going to check out. Minimum engagement, get through it, kind of head down, I don't want to talk about it. And in fact, in the train guard story that I tell, in that particular incident, I remember there was one train company that switched off its Twitter feed. There were all these people tweeting, going, what do I do? And is there any other way out of London? And all this kind of stuff. And they didn't reply at all. So clearly their team just went, nothing we can do about this. So we might as well just switch it off and come back to it later. So bury your head in the sand situation. Whereas this one train guard, what he was doing was just showing up. So instead of thinking, I've got to fix this because he can't, instead of feeling I am over responsible for it, like, this is my fault, or you know, why are you shouting at me? What he did differently was that he went, okay, how do I show up? What's my purpose here? My purpose here isn't to fix it. My purpose here isn't to get it right because I don't have any answers. But what I can do is I can show up. I can offer my presence. I can make eye contact. I can make conversation. I can offer presence, humanity, connection, compassion. And in doing that, he's still doing his job. His job in that moment isn't to make the problem go away, but his job is to be able to meet the people where they're at in that problem and to help to restore a little bit of sanity, a little bit of humanity and compassion into that situation. And he did that beautifully. So I think the lesson that we can learn in some of those situations is when you're feeling frustrated, when it feels like there's something beyond your control, but it's still affecting you, is what is my ultimate purpose? So if my ultimate purpose is to support my team, for example, how do I do that even in this shitty situation? You know, how do I do that in this situation that I can't control? I can't make it go away. So if I can't fix it, how do I still show up? And there was a similar story that I told in the book as well about a friend of mine who had a team member who was going through a disciplinary. And she actually disagreed with that disciplinary, but the decision was out of her hands. So she was like, well, what do? I don't want to go along with it because I don't support it. But equally, I don't just want to leave her in the lurch. So what she chose to do was to show up to the disciplinary, but show up as almost a witness for her team member. So just to be there for her. So there wasn't anything she could do to take away the process of what was happening to her. But what she could do was be a friendly face in the room and show her support in that way. So then there's something there about how do we show up for people, even when we can't fix it for them and we don't have all the right answers. And I think there's something really powerful in that.
That's really powerful. And actually, I was keen to ask you about support in times of struggle. You talk about community and different forms that support might take. What different kind of forms do you hear of that might be useful for our listeners?
So there's a bit in the book where I talk about the difference between a crowd and a community. The bigger the crowd gets, the more alone I'm going to feel, the more pressed down I'm going to feel. Whereas actually the community, the bigger the community gets, the more stronger I feel supported and that sort of thing. And I think there is something about when we look out for each other and when we're there for each other And not just in a, I can help you, not just in a one way, but in a two way sort of thing. The world grows. And one of the quotes that I put in there, the world of the generous gets larger and larger. It might be actually interesting to explore a different image that I write in the book about an area called Cannock Chase that's very local to me. And I went for a walk there with a friend of mine, and she was pointing out how all these birch trees had grown all very close to each other. And there were areas where their branches had been knocked off by the next tree. And basically they're just trying to get really tall and to compete for sunlight. So the tallest trees get the sunlight, it gets the fresh air. And it really reminded me of the corporate world, where it feels like we're all jostling up against each other. We're all trying to compete for a limited amount of space. The higher up we go, the more daylight we have, the more fresh air we have, the less we're cramped with other people. I mean, there's lots of physical and conceptual analogies we can take from that. And yet I remember thinking, I don't want to be like a birch tree. I don't want to be in a world where success means knocking everybody else down. And actually, maybe there's a different image for this. So I was thinking I'd rather be a large sprawling oak that has a whole variety of animals living in my branches and provides shelter and food. And actually, if we lived in that way, if we can live in an ecosystem where we're supporting each other, we can all breathe freer rather than in a place where we're comparing against and competing against each other.
I think that's a lovely analogy. I really like that. Multifaceted lives featuring in there as well. So thank you very much for that. Finally, coming back to this core concept of struggle from your book, I think when times are difficult, needing to find the positives when actually you're just trying to survive might feel quite overwhelming. And you talk about small changes, little steps. Mm-hmm. How would you suggest somebody who might be listening to us who actually thinks, as many people might do, given the year we've all been through and are continuing to go through, how would you suggest somebody might take some first small steps to finding some positive in a struggle?
So I think knowing that there will be some will help. So one of the things I talk about is finding the treasure and how often where we keep our treasure is not where we find it. So where we keep our treasure is in a beautiful museum somewhere with good lighting and everything's clean and it's all been polished. But where we find that treasure is often in the dirt, in the dark, in the caves. And so recognizing, okay, where I find my treasure is often in these tougher moments can just help us to recalibrate our radar a little bit. To recognize that, yes, it might be tough, but it's not just all tough, and that helps. But I think also recognizing that it's a process as well. So towards the end of the book, I talk about a three-step process that we can use as a way of framing struggle. And in the book, I call it something else, but we can call it the three R's here. So the first R is recognizing. So recognizing, this is tough. This is hard. Something's gone wrong. This hurts. And quite often we don't give ourselves that space to do that recognition. We go straight from noticing, something's wrong, to I've got to fix it. So we try and jump straight to resolution. Whereas actually sometimes what we need is just to sit in the moment and recognize the pain, the difficulty, and give ourselves space to recognize, look, I am struggling. Rather than I'm struggling, I've got to fix that, is I'm struggling and that's okay. And then the second thing that we can then go into, the second R, is reckoning. We can then start to, once we kind of come to terms with the fact that it's tough, we can then start to ask, okay, what is actually going on here? Maybe what is fear telling me? So if I am in fight and flight mode, how is that showing up? What are some of the things that fear is telling me? But also maybe I can activate some curiosity in the moment, because curiosity is often the antidote to fear. So whereas fear will say, oh no, something's happening, that's dangerous. Curiosity will go, ooh, that's interesting, something's happening. So we can, even that shift in curiosity can get us thinking differently about what's going on. So, okay, maybe the conventional way is shut and that feels like a disaster, but actually curiosity might go, what does this give us permission to do? What are some of the less trodden paths that we normally don't go down, but actually we can go down now because the conventional way is shut? So that's where we can maybe start to get creative and look for the possibility in the moment. And then after that comes the revelation. And that's often where we then find the treasure. So it's through the kind of curiosity, it's asking like, what am I making it to mean? What else could it mean? Yes, this is tough. What else can come out of this? And often the and is really important, because otherwise we tend to go but. And if we say, oh, this is tough, but I'll get through it. What we're doing is we're shutting off a part of that kind of noticing, a part of that experience. And equally, if we go, you know, yeah, it'll be great, but I'm still hurting. Again, where we're kind of going, it's one thing or the other. Whereas often life is a paradox, isn't it? It's a series of contradictions, and joy and sadness can exist in the same space. So even being able to go, and what else can this mean, can give us the opportunity to still be true, hold true that we're struggling and things are tough, and also go, what else can this be? And that's when we can get more creative. That's when we can set our radar. And that's when we often then start to notice the treasures in the moment. And that, you know, makes the experience much richer. And we also come out of it with something much more useful than if we just kind of shut our eyes and try and wade through it.
Fantastic. That's a really simple, doable, I think, and positive note to end on. So thank you so much, Grace. I've really enjoyed exploring this topic of struggle and how we can find positives and evolution, I suppose, from more difficult times. So thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you to all of our listeners as well. If you'd like to hear more about City Parents, do visit us at cityparents.co.uk. You can follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook or Twitter, and you can stay tuned for more from City Parents Talk coming soon. Thank you and goodbye.